Good morning, and welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carborough. My name is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer and editor, and each week here on the show, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science, both here in the Triangle area and elsewhere on occasion. We focus on one particular scientific topic of interest and bring in an expert or experts to speak to about the subject and give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 919-929-9601. And, of course, you're welcome to make comments and ask questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And there is a website for the program, which you can access at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. And you can access all of our past programs on the website, so please do check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also now available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, browse podcasts, enter Radio In Vivo, and you can subscribe and get the show downloaded to you every week. Of course, we've always also had podcasts available on the station's website as well. And I do want to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvarok. Claudio is a master storyteller and a performing poet and author. He is available for big bookings, so please check his website out at www.claudioarts.com. Claudio will be appearing on Readings with Joy here on WCOM next Monday at 11 a.m. if all gets confirmed, so I hope you'll make it a point to tune in for that. And I would like to remind you that this all-volunteer community radio station literally survives on your donations, so please do consider making a tax-deductible contribution. It's easy to do that at the station's website, communityradio.coop. All you have to do is hit the Donate Now button, and you can make a secure donation by filling out the form. Well, this week I am honored to welcome Dr. Greg Gibson to Radio In Vivo. Greg is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor in the Department of Genetics at North Carolina State University, where he has been on the faculty since 1998. He is also the Assistant Director for Life Sciences at the North Carolina Agricultural Research Service and serves as the Associate Director at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, whose director, Kathleen K. Smith, was on the show last month. Greg received his undergraduate degree from the University of Sydney and is a native Australian, and his PhD at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Greg's lab at North Carolina State specializes in the study of evolutionary quantitative genomics. Greg, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Good morning, Ernie. Thanks very much for having me.
Greg, before we drill down into your work, I'd like to get you to define some terms for us so that our listeners can have a good broad context in which to understand your research. First of all, what is quantitative genomics?
Oh, well, that's a good question. So quantitative just means complex, basically, or continuous. I think if you think about most of the variation you see around you, whether it's in height or in dimensions of psychology or different morphologies, then that's not regulated by a single gene. I think a lot of times when people think about genetics, they just imagine there's a gene for cancer or a gene for intelligence. It's never the case that it's that simple. Mm-hmm. Rather, you've got many, many genes interacting with a lot of environmental variables to produce the variation you see.
Sure.
So quantitative genetics is trying to disentangle all of those factors, the genetic and the environmental, and how they work together. And I guess in the last 5 or 10 years, with the advent of genomics, we've completely ramped up our technological abilities and our mathematical and statistical skills, and it's opened up a whole new vista of opportunities for dissecting complex traits in organisms as diverse as corals and plants and humans. So it's a very exciting time to be involved in this.
I see. I guess I was curious about the quantitative aspect. Is that as opposed to qualitative?
Well,
Or what is the quantitative?
So the quantitative is just the idea that you can rigorously measure things that are not discretely distributed, I guess. So it's not that simple, because you might have a disease such as diabetes or depression, which are somewhat discrete. So you can tell a diabetic person, there are definitions for that, or you can tell a schizophrenic person. But even in those cases, there's going to be an underlying liability, if you like, that is itself complex and continuous. Maybe there's a threshold response that puts you over into the disease class. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things... So, I mean, a classical... well, even something like a meristic trait, so the number of fingers that you have, most people have five, occasionally you get people with six, that will have a quantitative underpinning to it. But I guess the term is used mainly to distinguish from something like... or maybe blue eyes versus brown eyes, which is not necessarily quantitative. It's emphasizing the complexity of most genetic processes.
And in that complexity, that is controlled by the expression of the melange of genes involved in any particular trait, right?
That's correct. I think the other important component to it is just realizing that genetics is very rarely deterministic. So quantitative implies... these complex interactions between what you have in your genome and what nature and culture serve up.
I see. Well, thank you for explaining that to me. Greg, you have devoted much of your career to studying the genomics of one of the classic model organisms, the fruit fly, and I thank you for the pronunciation help, Drosophila melanogaster.
Melanogaster. Drosophila melanogaster. I'll say it to you in Australian, good old Australian. Drosophila melanogaster.
Okay. There are many people who have devoted their entire lives to studying these humble creatures. Mm-hmm. Why is the fruit fly such an important model for genetics and genomics?
Well, most simply just because of the generation time and the size. We can keep literally thousands of stocks in a laboratory and just keep going back to them and study them one after the other. If you have a genetic disease, say in humans such as diabetes, then you're restricted in your genetic analysis to working with pedigrees. And you can't go in and say, hey, I want you to mate with, I think you should marry this person, and then we'll have a look at your progeny 20 years later. It's kind of hard for a graduate student to work on that time scale, and it's kind of hard to get people to do that.
Postdocs are long, but not quite that long.
Not quite that long. And people are not quite that amenable to just mating with who you tell them to. So... what you can do with flies is just have these hundreds or thousands of stocks, and you can take them and you can cross them together in very defined ways, and it only takes about 2 weeks per generation, and they're very small, relatively cheap to keep. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The other is, I guess, to someone who works in this field, just the beauty of them. When I started out in the mid-1980s doing my PhD, the whole field of development was broken open by the discovery of genes that sort of specify where legs are and where antennae are and where wings are. And in that period of about 10 years in the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, we just saw the commonality of development from Drosophila through nematodes through even to plants, but humans. It became very, very clear that the organizing principles are the same in all organisms. And the sort of, not necessarily biochemistry, but the cell biology you could do at the time was just striking. You can see these genes coming on and off and interacting with each other just in real time. It's just, there's a visceral attraction to it, to biologists.
Sure. Now, was that largely as a result of advances in imaging and things like that?
Everything came together at once. Yeah, imaging, so that you could label different RNAs with red and green and different colored dyes, and you got these multicolored images. Very clear. I think Sean Carroll has done a beautiful job in his books, recently popular books, sort of bringing that to the general public. I recommend those to you, Sean Carroll.
Okay.
Then in the 90s, as I mentioned a little bit a while back, the statistical tools advanced, but more importantly, computational power really came in so that you could do things. So that added there. And then, of course, the molecular genetics revolution, which allows us to manipulate DNA, and flies were one of the first organisms that people could really make transgenic, and you could do things like making a fly grow an eye on the middle of its leg.
Right.
You could manipulate them and do these extraordinary things that you can't have a hope of doing.
Those pictures of the mouse with the ear on top of its head and stuff like that.
So that's not a genetic change. That was an implantation of a deer that grew inside the mouse. But, yeah, that's a similar sort of thing. I mean, I...
But for specific purposes.
Yes, yes.
Obviously.
So, I mean, my PhD, for example, was growing legs on the head of a fly. There's a mutation called antennapedia, and it turns out that these genes that do that pattern your cranial nerves and pattern the vertebrae of humans. You can take the human gene and put it in the fly and do these dramatic transformations of one part of the body into another.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. I've seen the movie.
X-Files also had a portion of the fly, yeah. But the X-Files have also had an episode on it, which is pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rick, what you're talking about in the big picture, I assume, is that really much of the work these days is centered around efforts to link genotypes to phenotypes.
That's really correct. Yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting areas of modern genetics.
And as we're defining terms here, could you kind of elaborate for us exactly what that means, mm-hmm. and why that is so important?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you take most traits, the things that you observe, be it hair color, be it height, be it IQ, there's a component of that trait that's transmitted from parent to offspring. So children always tend to resemble their parents. And we now know that that's because of what we call genetic factors in the main. There are also going to be transmission of environmental factors from parent to children as well. I mean, salt usage or something like that often tends to run in families because of the amount that you get sort of culturally from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
So in humans, it's actually pretty hard to tease apart genetic and environmental factors, but they're all interacting together. Your average trait probably has somewhere between 20 to 50% of the variance is explained by the genes, so what you get in your DNA, that sort of material, genetic material. The rest is, I don't want to say due to environment, but you get a sense there that the variation around us is, in fact, mostly not necessarily genetic, but it's environmental, and it's this interaction that's going on. So the genotype refers to what you're receiving from your parents in the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be able to say, well, at location 7,666,238 on this chromosome, I've got an A and you have a T at that position. And that may indicate that you're more likely to get diabetes than someone who has a T. So the A's may be more likely to get diabetes.
Sure.
But that will not determine that. Whether you do or don't get the disease will be a function also of all your other genes in the genome, but also be a function of diet and stress and all sorts of other cultural and environmental factors. So when you add them all together, you end up with the phenotype, so that's what we observe. And one of the tasks for geneticists is to try to work out what the relationship between the phenotype and the genetic factors.
I see. And certainly, as the field progresses, it seems like you're being able to tackle more and more complex mm-hmm. phenotypes and make those kinds of links, such as behavioral and developmental characteristics. Is that the state of the research in fruit fly work as well?
In many ways. So one of the leading lights in the fruit fly work is actually one of my colleagues, Trudy McKay at NC State University, is very, very prominent mm-hmm. nationally. It has sort of led the way in most of this work. She started working with bristles, is what she's most famous for, and has also been looking at lifespan and a number of other traits. And gradually moving to more and more complex ones, such as aggression, for example, in fruit flies.
Mm-hmm.
Our own group started out with looking at wing shape, so the shape of the wing, which is already more complex than, say, something numeric like number of bristles, because you have to, the way you measure the wing is itself, there's a lot of variation in how you can measure it.
Sure.
So, yes, in Drosophila, we want to get to a point where we can associate differences in the genes with differences in the phenotype. I guess when we sort of embarked on genomic approaches 5 to 10 years ago, the hope was that there'd be a lot of similarities with what's going on in humans, but that we would be able to use the genetic advantages of the fly to make further inferences. For various reasons, there are actually difficulties of working with flies, and their advantages now with humans. The genomic tools have so outstripped what we have in these model organisms, and you can do so much with human genetics now.
Sure.
That what you're left with is not so much flies as a model for humans, which has been the case for a lot of, but at least for cell biology, you're left with flies as a model for flies. But we learn about evolutionary principles. We're just learning really very, very basic fundamental processes.
I
think a phenomenon that I've been interested in throughout my career is something called canalization.
Canalization.
So, and that's the idea that traits evolve not just to have some optimal phenotype, but actually organisms are, if you like, buffered so that the genetic system is able to absorb environmental insults and genetic mutations. So, and that's a just fundamentally, it's a pretty esoteric problem, but it's a fundamentally important problem as to how you get stability in systems. Mm-hmm. So you've got 20,000 genes interacting to produce an organism, incredible complexity, and yet it's robust. And there's no prearranged plan for how things work. The whole system unfolds in a process of development without actually there being a template that someone's directing it. So how that robustness comes about is really interesting. And then from an evolutionary point of view, how robustness evolves. So you can come up with a mechanism for producing, say, a new shape of the wing. If that's really advantageous to the organism, then the question becomes, well, are there ways of stabilizing that shape so that it won't change? And then maybe, well, that has implications then. So if the environment changes, can you unlock that variation?
Right.
And I actually think that that's actually probably going to end up being quite relevant for human disease, for example. So if you take complex diseases like diabetes and depression, which are epidemic in human society now. So in the last two or three generations, they've gone from a few percent to 10, 20% incidence.
Sure. Which cannot be explained by genetics.
It can't be explained by genetic changes. It just hasn't been the time. So it's clearly an interaction between genetics and environment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some hypotheses out there that we sort of evolved to be more adapted. So there's something called the thrifty genes hypothesis, which says that our metabolism evolved at a time when food was scarce. And now, where we have very rapid access, continual access to fatty foods and high sugar foods and so forth, that our metabolism is not really designed to handle that.
Right.
And that's leading to obesity and diabetes type phenotypes.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is something slightly more subtle than that, and that's sort of saying a lot of the variation that you're going to see associated with diabetes and obesity is not necessarily variation that was adapted to some prior condition, but it was variation that was hidden, that was buffered, and so it was really functionally neutral. It didn't have much effect, but now in our modern environment, it becomes functional.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of a decanalization, there's an increase in variation now. So I think we're seeing that across the human spectrum is that you're getting much more variability.
So the variability was there all along,
uh-huh.
and the environmental conditions as they change is kicking that in.
Uncover that. So you could sort of think of it an iceberg, and what we see as the tip of the iceberg is a visible variation. And now maybe as sea level changes, you start exposing, well, of course, that's physically incorrect, but as a metaphor, you're starting to see the bit of the iceberg that was underneath the surface of the sea before, and that's what's contributing to modern disease. So that sort of concept comes from working with a model organism like Drosophila, where you sort of are more free to think in different directions.
Sure, sure. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Greg Gibson from the North Carolina State University Department of Genetics. Greg, I was fascinated to read on your lab's webpage that in some of your work, you're kind of going against the grain of most of this type of research, that unlike most researchers who start with a complex trait and try to identify the genes involved with that phenotype, you actually start with a set of genes that are of interest and explore their association with candidate traits. Why have you taken that particular approach, and how has it informed your results?
Well, we call that a reverse quantitative genetic approach, and it really just borrows on a trend in Mendelian genetics. So Mendelian genetics, I guess, is the genetics of non-quantitative traits, if you like. So, you know, whether it's wrinkled or smooth peas, classically, or if it's a cystic fibrosis might be an example of a Mendelian disease. A single gene disease. So the way that those genes were discovered was by taking individuals who had the disease and working back to the gene. The other approach that sort of classical geneticists do is they make mutations, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they try to work out then from those mutations to a disease phenotype. So you might now have a list of genes that have come out of some sort of study, and you say, well, I wonder how they affect metabolism or how they affect the phenotype. So we're just extending that into a quantitative realm. And the advantage is of it are that so one advantage is we really believe that pleiotropy is extremely important in genetics. And what I mean by pleiotropy is that genes affect a lot of different processes, okay? And that's also a very common misconception, I think, that people tend to think there's a gene for cancer or there's a gene for intelligence or so forth. In fact, what there are there genes that regulate other genes, and there are genes that encode enzymes, and there are genes that encode cell surface components. And then the way those genes interact together determines whether or not they're influencing memory or embryogenesis or other processes.
Building those pathways.
Building those pathways. And so almost what you see is an emergent property of the pathway. And we're now seeing then things like genes that are very important in patterning the early embryo, that maybe make sure that the tail forms at the back of the embryo instead of the front of the embryo. That same gene might be involved in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, well, how can that be? That doesn't really fit our sort of platonic conception of a gene for some sort of trait. Well, the answer is, might be something like, well, that gene's involved in translocating RNA to a particular part of the embryo or translocating RNA to a particular part of the synapse, which is important for establishing memory.
Sure.
So there's a common underlying molecular mechanism, a consequence of which is that the same gene can influence very, very different traits. So you're not putting all your eggs in the one basket if you take the reverse approach. So you start out with the genes, and then we can study. So, for example, in our work, we looked at something called the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway. We took one of the key genes in that, and we said, well, how is that involved in determination of wing shape? How is it involved in determination of photoreceptors or the shape of the eye?
Mm-hmm.
How is it involved in determining the shape of the early embryo? And we know that the gene is involved in all of those processes, and it turns out that different variants, so different what we call polymorphisms, different nucleotide changes in the gene, are associated with different traits. So it's the same gene, but different parts of the gene are important for variation in the traits they're regulating. And Trudy McKay, I mentioned earlier, and others are starting to see similar results.
I see. Well, from your description, we all know how complex this work is. It sounds like it's potentially endless, mm-hmm. but it does sound like that with the advances in computation and statistical modeling that you at least can start getting a handle on some of this, which I'm sure would have implications, directly into the human.
Well, we keep just refining our microscope, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the 70s and 80s, the big concentration in quantitative genetics was on something called QTL mapping or quantitative trait locus mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And there what people did was set up crosses. So you might have two different varieties of corn, for example, that are a tall and a short, or a high yield and a low yield.
Right. I had one of the mouse genetics folks
okay.
on here who was talking about they're working on a big cross right now.
Right, and that's still an extremely important part of genetics, forming crosses, and then you cross the progeny together and you look at the grandchildren, or technically the F2 progeny, and they segregate all of the variation that was present in the parents in mixed up combinations. And in linkage mapping, what you do is you just take random anonymous markers throughout the genome and you ask which ones are linked with or associated with the phenotype you observe. So you can say, ultimately, you can use that to map the gene for cystic fibrosis or for lignin content in forest trees or for coat color in mice, whatever it is you're interested in.
Sure.
It turns out that for quantitative traits, that has relatively low resolution. So you can only get down to maybe 2 or 3% of the genome that way, and that will typically be maybe 100 genes. So it gets you to a part of the genome, but not all of the way there.
And that's the locus.
And that's the locus. That's the gene. So the locus locus really is just a region of the genome.
I see.
And it depends how precisely you want to define it. But for some purposes, that's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So a lot of markers now that have been used in, say, in biomedicine to sort of predict whether or not someone will have Huntington's disease is likely to get Huntington's disease will be markers that are not necessarily in the gene itself, but are in its vicinity, and you can give a fairly accurate assessment. As geneticists, though, we really ultimately want to get down to the genes. I mean, that's what evolution acts on. It's what the determinants, or I hate the word determinant, the factors that influence the traits are really, it's not the gene, it's the nucleotides within the gene we're interested in. So it turns out to get down to that level, we need to go beyond the F2. We have to have a lot more jumbling up, a lot more recombination to the F100 or the F1000.
So when you say F2 or F100, you're talking about the generation.
The generation time. So if we could sort it, it's one thing to have the F2, so the grandchildren, but you can imagine going down to the great 100 times grandchildren, and you've just jumbled up all of that variation.
And in the fruit fly, that only takes 2 weeks per generation, right?
Yeah, it's still a long time, though. It's about a graduate student's worth there. But it in order to jumble things up sufficiently to get resolution to the individual gene, you need hundreds, if not thousands, of generations. Uh-huh. Well, it turns out that the human species is, about 5,000 generations old. And the human genome has a structure to it wherein each gene is almost an island of variation itself, or it's a little bit smaller than that. So we can go across an entire population now in human genetics. So you can sample a couple of thousand people, perhaps those with and without disease, and then you can compare their genetic variants. It's called a genome-wide association scan. Mm-hmm. And you can actually hone in with this, it's called linkage disequilibrium mapping, this approach to get to the actual genes and eventually perhaps the actual variants that are responsible for disease susceptibility for differences in physiology. We'd like to be able to do that in flies, but for technical reasons it actually turns out that it's probably not going to work so well in flies. Flies are a lot more variable and they don't have these big blocks. So in fact, flies is more like a 100,000 generations. The species have been around so long, and that means the genome is so jumbled up that we'd actually have to sample at a resolution which is beyond current technology.
I see. Well, as you've described, the fruit fly certainly has been one of the major model organisms in genetics and genomics for the past 100 years or so. Mm-hmm. And we all know how significant it was that the human genome was sequenced. How significant in the progress of the field was the sequencing of the Drosophila genome, which I believe was accomplished in 2000?
So the Drosophila melanogaster genome was accomplished in 2000. Wonderful accomplishment. Has really had most of its impact in facilitating more cell biological and Mendelian genetic research. In the time since that happened, you've seen a real shift now in the fly field. People are a lot more interested in flies as a model for disease. So, for example, synapse formation or parts of metabolism and so forth. Mm-hmm. What you will see in the next couple of months is actually they will be publishing the sequences of 12 different species of Drosophila.
Which you've been involved with, right?
Which I've been involved in as one of the genomics members of the community. That's going to be extremely exciting, and that was work funded by the National Institutes of Human Genome Research in part. Because they wanted a model for comparative genomics. So you're probably aware now that we're having the sequences of not just the humans now and not just some of the other primates like chimpanzee and macaque, but we will soon have the sequences where we have the sequence of the mouse, of a dog, of they're working on some marsupials, so the tamar wallaby and an opossum. They're working on a platypus, they're working on elephant and aardvark, so they're sort of trying to get a broad representation of vertebrates so we can do what's called comparative genomics, and that's finding the things that are common between species. Mm-hmm. Well, they funded doing this for Drosophila because we can cover 100 million years of evolution, which is what's now represented in these 12 species, and they're very, very different from each other, and yet flies all look pretty much the same to you and I.
Sure.
And we hope that that will be a resource that will really open up, allowing us to sort of see how evolution happens over that time period, what's conserved, what changes. Having the power to compare, I mean, let nature do the experiments for you, basically, over that long period of time, and you can see what's important for maintaining things that are the same, what's been important in divergence. So that will be a tremendous resource.
And that's coming soon.
And that's, I just got an email yesterday saying that the latest target date for those papers is December 15th.
Oh, wow.
Production of those, yeah.
So you must be very excited about that.
It's a pretty exciting time for this.
Well, I hit you at just the right time.
Just the right time. Yeah.
Greg, I understand that genetically speaking, humans are share about 44% similarity with flies,
okay,
according to my reading, and that about 61% of known human disease genes, mm-hmm, have a recognizable match in the genetic code of flies,
mm-hmm,
and that about 50% of fly protein sequences have mammalian analogs.
Right.
So with all of that in mind, how much can the fly tell us about human physiological mechanisms and diseases?
Yeah. So I think you have to be a little bit careful at jumping from statistics like that to concluding that things are the same. But by the same token, there are clearly similarities. I mean, one of my favorite examples of that is a gene called Tin Man, mm-hmm, in flies. So named because they lack a heart. Okay. So this is the human ortholog of that, of the Tin Man gene. If you knock it out, then you have defects in your left ventricle. So it's very, very clear that that gene is ancestrally involved in heart specification. So it's way before the splits of invertebrates. I mentioned the Hox genes earlier, so Antennapedia and these genes that I've worked on that specify your cranial nerves, mm-hmm, they're conserved. Mm-hmm. So there's this great, great conservation of mechanisms involved in development.
And that's a real key concept, is it not? The conservation.
That's a real key concept.
Species.
But it goes more deeply than that, I think. And you could cite similar numbers for yeast. So something like 30% of human proteins have a homologue in, mm-hmm, yeast.
There are days I feel that.
You feel that. But yeast, obviously, they don't remember. They don't have cancer, and yet these genes are involved in cancer in humans. So very clearly present in yeast. When you say, "Well, that doesn't seem to make sense," but the answer is that genes aren't specifying a phenotype; they're specifying a function in a pathway, and those pathways now have diverged in what they do. Mm-hmm. So the idea of these model organisms is that you may not actually have a perfect model for diabetes or a perfect model for depression in any of these model organisms, but what you have is a model of how the genes interact with one another, and we can dissect them. So you can maybe take presenilin, for example, which is a gene very important in the etiology of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
There's companies now that are actually making a living off this. They'll put presenilin in the fly, and it turns out that they induce neuronal degradation in a time-dependent manner. So as flies get older, you see a roughening of the surface of the eye, which is indicative of neuronal degradation. You can now screen for genes that modify that. So you can find genes that will rescue or enhance the effect of that presenilin. Well, these are probably genes that are involved in the pathway of disease progression, mm-hmm, in Alzheimer's, mm-hmm, disease. Mm-hmm. And if you identify those genes, you can now go back and study what they're doing in mammalian models, whether it's mouse or dogs or humans. You can maybe send them to drug companies and say, well, are they potential targets for drugs? So that's an example of the way flies are used.
I see. So the comparative genomics really does have a great deal to tell us potentially about disease mechanisms, targets for therapy in humans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think all human geneticists would agree, because they've just got the tools now. They can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do the genetics, obviously, but they can do cell biology and biochemistry now in different ways. But if you look over the last 20 or 30 years, the way that different model organisms, and I'd even include in this plants, I mean, a lot of plant research is funded by the NIH. People may not be aware of that, just because of the commonalities.
Sure.
They all come together You know, you see that in the award of Nobel Prizes for Physiology and Medicine to fly and worm geneticists and yeast geneticists.
Sure, sure. Now, are you doing any work that could be characterized as comparative genomics, as you've been discussing?
Well, I'm actually not particularly heavily involved in the comparative genomics, because my focus is actually on the species level.
I see.
I'm interested in variation within species and perhaps within closely related species. So for that, we more focus on polymorphism and using the tools just to study, mm-hmm, variation in our own genomes. But a lot of colleagues, obviously, of mine are very much using comparative genomic information, whether it's to look at Anopheles mosquitoes, is a Drosophila example. So all insects are related in ways that we can use comparative genomics to move from flies to mosquitoes to understanding more about malaria or other insect disease vectors.
Sure.
But no, I'm not really doing comparative genomics. I do have, you're probably going to ask me about this in a minute, but part of my lab is starting to work a little bit on canine genetics.
Yep, that was three questions down,
ahead. Well, I think that's a wonderful example of comparative genetics. You know, the beauty of the dog model is that dogs share so much of our environment. You know, they eat our food and they go for walks where we go. They have the same pathogen exposure, well, not the same, but similar.
Sure.
Environmental toxins obviously are different. They get diseases at similar stages of their lives, inflammatory bowel disease or cancer or neurological disorders. Mm-hmm. They're all there in dogs, and oftentimes at similar frequencies. And even you're seeing a parallel in this sort of epidemic nature of diseases, so atopy, for example, in dogs, so this skin disease related to asthma, first described case in 1942, now thought to affect something like 10% of all dogs.
Really?
So it's really paralleling the rise of incidence in asthma. It's clearly an immune disorder. So you're not going to find the same.
So even epidemiologically, we're seeing similarities.
Well, yes, but we don't know yet how. I mean, clearly it's not going to be the same mutations or polymorphisms, mm-hmm. but it's very likely going to be similar sets of genes involved in the way they interact. And it turns out that dogs have a lot of potential as an organism for looking at complex diseases because they have even more structure to their genome than humans. So if you look at the different breeds, so dogs and humans both evolved as species in the last 100,000 years, what is recognizable modern species. And then to some extent, humans have undergone some population divergence that you see in different geographic areas and races and so forth.
Sure.
But dogs, it's so much stronger when you look at the breeds that have been developed over the last 30 or 40 years or 100 years, maybe 10 or 15, 20 generations. Some breeds go back to as few as a dozen founder individuals. So they've got a huge amount of genetic structure within those, and that's a real advantage for doing quantitative genetics. So the idea behind a lot of the canine genome project has been that we could work this up as a model for finding genes for asthma or atopy or different cancers or different neurological disorders. So I'm pretty excited about those prospects.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly one of the neurological disorders I know you're looking at is epilepsy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for mentioning that.
And not just for the humans, but apparently it's a very, very common condition in dogs themselves, and I know you're working with some of the vet school folks on that project.
Right, and, I have a lot of wonderful colleagues at the vet school at NC State. I think Cara Manana and Natasha Olby are neurologists I'm working with there. There's a group called the Apple Canine Foundation, which some of your listeners may want to go and order a calendar from the Apple Canine Foundation. Just find them on the web.
Sure.
So they've just voluntarily supported our research, which is really nice of them, just a few $100s, but it makes a big difference because we hope to sample about 500 epileptic dogs. And just as in humans, you get a fraction, maybe 10, 15, 20% of the dogs in our case that are not responsive to the drug. So in case of dogs, the drug of choice is phenobarbital.
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't work, oftentimes potassium bromide is used as well. But something like 15% of dogs will be refractory to the drug.
I see. And am I correct that something like 10% of dogs suffer from epilepsy?
No, not that much.
No, I misread that.
But it's about 10% of the dogs that suffer from epilepsy will not respond to the drug.
I see.
So pharmacogenetics is actually not so much looking for the variants that cause the disease or contribute to the disease, but rather looking for the variants that affect whether you respond to the drug.
Right.
Okay. And those variants can affect things like metabolism of the drug. So when you take a drug, there are enzymes that actually will metabolize that.
Mm-hmm.
There are other genes that are important for delivering the drug to the right tissue, perhaps getting it across the blood-brain barrier or delivering it to the liver or other places. And then other target genes will be things that the drugs actually act on, whether they're potassium channels or sodium channels and so forth.
Sure.
So these are all candidate targets
as
of things.
Human pharmacogenomics.
So very, very similar to human pharmacogenomics. And a lot of the buzz in human genetics now is really in pharmacogenomics because just economically, from a point of view of clinical trials, identifying the population that might respond to a drug. I think dosing is very, very important in humans because of the toxicity of drugs or the other deleterious side effects. If you can help with the dosing by identifying which people are more likely to respond to aspirin, you know, anything from aspirin to
chemotherapeutics.
So you have similar things in dogs, and again, it's not going to be exactly the same polymorphisms, but it's quite likely that the same genes have been the target, will harbor variation, and so that's what we're testing. So we've gone out and we've taken about 30 of these candidate genes, and we've just designed a chip now that we just got our first data back 2 days ago. It's amazing, 72,000 variants scored in a couple of days.
Wow!
just for about $10,000. That's I mean, 2 years ago you couldn't even have dreamed of doing this. But what we hope to be able to do is to find genetic factors that will indicate whether a dog's likely to respond to phenobarbital.
And will that actually have translational impact in dogs themselves? Will this?
That's the hope. We'll see. We'll see what impact that has.
But it certainly has implications for human disease as well.
I think so.
I would assume.
So, and it's certainly not just epilepsy in dogs where this is important. All sorts of diseases in dogs you could look at, from cancers to bowel disease and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very important area. And we don't really, I mean, you can ask the question, why would there be so much variation for response to drugs in humans? In fact, a lot of the enzymes that are important for that, clearly they didn't evolve so that some people responded to aspirin and others didn't. They're variants that are there for other reasons, and some of them may just be there for neutral purposes in this sort of this buffering idea I had before.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them may be involved in things like drought tolerance or maybe adaptations to lactose or some milk drinking.
Sure.
Who knows? We don't really know the reasons why there's this variation, but I think that's another reason to have comparative models, because you can, when you look at the human genome, you tend to, human geneticists like to think that we're unique as a species and what we see there is something special. But when you look at all of these other organisms, you realize that exactly the same processes are going on in dogs and wolves and cats and elephants.
Right. Well, Greg, you've alluded to this certainly quite a bit. And one of my points of curiosity here is, why is the study of these genetic variations so critical? As you refer to them, single nucleotide polymorphisms or SNPs. And also, I know a lot of work is being done in haplotypes, which are groups of related SNPs. What do these genetic variations tell us?
Well, It gets back to this idea that most of the variation that's functionally important is not a single change. I think when people think of the immediate advantage of the Human Genome Project was that it allowed us to find the genes for things like cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease and muscular dystrophy. Wonderful, wonderful breakthroughs have had a big impact.
Sure.
But if you think about what really impacts most of our lives, I mean, every single one of us is affected at some point in our lives by relatives or friends or ourselves suffering from diabetes and from depression and from cardiovascular disease. These are complex diseases, so there's a lot of the variation for that disease. So the current paradigm, I guess, is that there may be a dozen or 20 or so common variants in the human gene pool, each of which influences maybe 2 or 3 or 4%, 5% of the susceptibility to cardiovascular disease, for example. So there's some very good examples that researchers at Duke University here have discovered or have investigated, where we can actually see what's happened is that variant has gone from a frequency of a few percent to a frequency of 20-25% in particular populations, and that's either protective or against cardiovascular disease perhaps, or it's causing cardiovascular disease. And we can actually study these variants that are affecting susceptibility. So they're not causing it, but they're associated with it. And,
right.
and what we ultimately need to be able to do is to find all 10 or 15 or 20 of these and see how they've co-evolved, see how they interact together, and try to understand just why they're there and what we can do to ameliorate their negative consequences.
And the more we learn about things like that, the more we can potentially do about it.
Yeah. Well,
We all have genetic variants inherently, right?
Right, and that's a very important concept. I mean, people like to think of good genes and bad genes. Well, we all have variants in our genomes that if we were homozygous for them, so if we sort of could go through and how would I say that without being too technical, but if we have variants in our genome that would kill us if both of our copies of our genes were the same way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So our genome is just full of these what we call lethal factors, and they're masked by the fact that we're heterozygous, that we get one copy from parent, one from mother, one from the father.
Right.
That's just conceptually, I think, an important point to realize, that all of us have bad genes.
Sure.
And so it means all of us have susceptibility to different classes of disease.
And respond to drugs in different ways.
And respond to drugs in different ways.
Respond to environmental insults in different ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's such a natural process. Yeah.
Well, Greg, I want to find out a little bit more about you. What originally led you into this line of work, and how did you settle on Drosophila as your specialty?
That's a great question. I wonder myself sometimes. So both of my parents are biologists. My father is a soil microbiologist. My mother is a forest tree. Did her PhD actually went in my 40s in forest tree physiology. So naturally, I avoided biology as much as I could as a kid. And my father gave me a book on genetics when I was in college, and I was just reading it, and I got to chapter 3 or 4 and said, my God, this is fascinating. I really think I'll spend my life working out how the genetic code works. And then, of course, the next night I read chapter 5 and discovered it, that they knew.
Right.
So, but reading on, and I decided to take some biology classes, and I just got fascinated by a process called transdetermination.
Transdetermination,
okay. Which was some classical work in developmental biology where you can take... So the appendages of an adult fly, so like wings or legs, grow out of something called an imaginal disc.
Imaginal
disc. It's sort of like the embryo for the appendage, and it grows inside the pupa.
I see.
And you can take one of these discs out of a pupa and inject it into another pupa, and you can just keep it going at an undeveloped state, so not terminally differentiated, it's just sort of passing through and through.
Mm-hmm.
It gets bigger and bigger, so you cut it up, and then you transfer it into another. And then if you let the pupa mature, then that disc will grow into what it should be. And transdetermination was this phenomenon whereby if you put a leg disc, so one of these imaginal discs for a leg, and you cultured that for 10 or 15 generations, when you grew it up, it actually would have become an antenna. Or the other way around, actually, an antenna would become a leg. And there was this whole series of progressions, and they're called transdetermination, where the identity of something had become a different organ. Well, my doctoral advisor, Walter Gehring, had studied that as a graduate student, and then he cloned this antennapedia complex in his lab in the mid-1980s, where they discovered these Hox genes. And these were genes that did the same thing, converted an antenna into leg. So I was just fascinated by this question, well, what's the similarity between those?
Sure.
And we didn't have the technology to be able to, we still don't have the technology to put those, or the, not so much technology, the knowledge base to put those two things together yet. But I was fascinated by that. And, you know, a 21-year-old Australian gets a chance to go to Switzerland to do a PhD for 4 years. It's pretty exciting. So I did that.
Sure.
It was a very, very exciting time, wonderful time. And so I was hooked on Drosophila just because of the beauty of the system. And it's still a beautiful system. You could do genetics, as we've talked about. Things have changed in the last 5 or 10 years, though. And with the Human Genome Project, you can do so much in human genetics now. So I think that's much more attractive to undergraduates now. I certainly see that it's, there are some undergraduates who are still attracted to the sort of just esoteric beauty of Drosophila, but most want to be engaged in, rightly so, in directly in human genetic research or mouse genetic research. So I don't know if I'd do it all over again, but I'm glad I've had the path I've had.
Absolutely. Well, it certainly sounds like everything you've done, you know, it's not just siloed into the fruit fly community. Mm. It certainly is very cognizant of all the implications in the wider arena.
Yeah, and I think part of that too is who you're surrounded by. I mean, I have wonderful colleagues at the vet school, wonderful colleagues in our Bioinformatics Research Center, and wonderful colleagues throughout the Triangle. I mean, this is just such an exciting area. You know, I'm working with people at Duke right now. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of colleagues at UNC. It's tremendous to see these different branches of biology being brought together by genomics.
And it does seem like the Triangle is a real hotbed for this type of research. I certainly noticed in preparing for our conversation today that North Carolina State, I was perhaps not quite aware, is a real leading institution in this line of work. And, of course, Duke and, as you mentioned, Duke and UNC are too.
Well, we all have our different strengths, but you're right. We're blessed here in the Triangle that we've got all of these things going on. I was certainly attracted by the strength in quantitative genetics when I came to NC State. It's really taught me so much. It's fantastic. And I had no idea, I guess, when I came. You know, I came out of a sort of the more liberal college, liberal arts environment. I was at Stanford and then at Michigan. And I came to NC State, which is a land-grant institution, so you have, instead of having people working on mice and Drosophila, you have people working on forest trees and pigs and...
Tobacco.
Tobacco is another story, but yeah. But we're all asking very similar questions, and you have different advantages, but something that genomics does is it allows us to ask the same questions in these parallel systems, and we're seeing that more and more. It's opening up great prospects for integrative research.
Oh, that's very exciting. In the context of asking where your research is headed from here, I want to hear more about the 72,000 variants you're expecting here shortly. It sounds like a very exciting time for your own work.
So, the dog work, I've only got a small pilot grant to work on, so I'm not sure where that will go.
Okay.
Right now. I can't predict. Invite me back in a couple of years and I'll be somewhere completely different in what we're doing. There's one project that I might mention that I'm really fascinated in right now is what I call a human transition project. And that's, I think, genotype by environment interaction, what we call that technically, but just basically this idea that the impact of our genetic variation is really, it has on our phenotype, is very much a function of the environment we grew up in. So I'm really interested in studying, comparing genetically matched populations that have very different environments. You know, we for the last two or three generations have moved off 10-acre farms where we grew our own food to living in quarter-acre blocks shopping at Piggly Wiggly, and that's had a massive impact on our lifestyle. It's increased stress levels, it's changed our social structure, so it's diet, it's pathogen exposure, stress, all of these sorts of things. Yeah. I'm just really interested in that difference there, so I'm interested in going to different places in the world. We're starting in Morocco here in a month or so time, and taking a graduate student, or he's taking me to Morocco to work on different populations there from living traditional nomadic lifestyle and living in city areas, and we want to do some comparisons of the genetics, or the impact of the genetics on the immune system.
I see.
And how those different cultural and environmental factors impact what the genes do for us.
What type of population would you be comparing them
to? So we'll be
to?
Looking at Berbers, actually, going up into the mountains, Atlas Mountains.
Mm-hmm. And bring back some rugs.
Bring back some rugs, if you like, yeah.
But you know, who would be your baseline to compare the Berbers to? Would it be more urban?
Well, we'll have Berbers living in urban and rural lifestyles.
Okay.
Okay. And you can find hundreds of sort of those matched populations in the world. It's a little bit naive at this point, but I think you sort of get the idea. Is I really have this interest in the impact that environmental and cultural change has on it. So what we have a genetic legacy over 100,000 years of human evolution, which is really affecting not just disease susceptibility, but psychosocial factors. Just who we are as a people is an interaction between this extraordinary environment that we've created and continue to create in the last 15, 20 years, in particular, just changing our environment. And that the impact of that is on our genetics and on our who we are is something that I think we can study by putting together genomics, maybe with anthropological studies and cultural studies. I think that is really integrative. So I guess I'm moving away from Drosophila in some sense. I don't think I'll ever give up Drosophila completely because, you know, you just get hooked on them. They're my little guys. But
right.
it's exciting to be able to integrate your concepts into the human system, or the canine system, perhaps.
It certainly sounds like this feeds right into your work with the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, that much of what you're describing is the kind of work that some of your colleagues there are engaged with, and that kind of integrative approach you described.
Right. So the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, I know you had Kathleen Smith, the director of that center, on a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
That the NSF funded that to really be a think tank or a place that we could bring scientists, you know, paleontologists, molecular evolutionists, biogeographers, organismal biologists, who traditionally maybe have not talked to each other. We can bring them in together, and they will work together at the old Irwin Mill building in Durham.
Right.
We have working groups. We can get them doing synthetic research. I'm somewhat involved. I have a couple of people there who are working on outreach aspects and educational aspects of evolutionary biology. So we're facing challenging times obviously in the teaching of evolution in this country. And we just are trying to do things to really promote the positive sides of evolutionary biology.
I see. So are you working in terms of the education and outreach activities, undergraduate, high school, primary schools? All of the above?
No, more tertiary level. So it is more of a research institute. So we're working on publicizing contemporary research. I think we had a group of 20 or 30 leading educators come in the summer, and the sort of consensus was that one of the real obstacles we face is the quality of evolution teaching, mm-hmm. and incorporating new learning methods into instruction. So that's where we'll focus.
I see. Well, that is certainly potentially the subject for a whole other program.
Absolutely.
Well, Greg, we are just about out of time already, believe it or not.
Yeah.
My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning has been Dr. Greg Gibson, who is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor in the Department of Genetics at North Carolina State University. And we have been talking about evolutionary quantitative genomics. And Greg, thank you so much for joining me on the program today and giving us a real fascinating glimpse into the world of genomics and genetics and the little fruit fly.
Well, Ernie, thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure. And thanks very much for all you're doing on this show. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much. Our next live Radio In Vivo, as of right now, is going to be on November 29th. And my guest will be Dr. Sheila Collins, of the CIIT Centers for Health Research in Research Triangle Park. Dr. Collins is a very prominent researcher in the biomolecular mechanisms underlying diabetes, obesity, and metabolism, much of which Greg was alluding to. And she is also a very dynamic personality. So it should be a great show, and I hope you will make it a point to tune in. I thank you for listening. This is Ernie Hood. Join me again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, please do make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. Thanks a lot.